Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. If you have a business, you want to make your money a certain way, and then you want to have your money make you more money. And I think that is what this topic is all about. The book is called The Uncertainty Solution, How to Invest with Confidence in the Face of the Unknown. And let me just read something from the summary that is really cool. I've never heard it put this way. Jennings uses mental models to create a lattice work of wisdom that will help you evaluate investment advice and learn better behavior in the face of uncertainty. To name a few, you should ignore expert predictions. I totally agree with that. Be wary of stories, all right? And try to invest like a dead person. I have no idea what the hell that means. Thank God we have the author here, John Jennings, to explain. Thanks so much for being here, man.
Happy to be here, Mike. Super excited.
Invest like a dead person. That catches people's attention. What does that mean before we get into the book?
Yeah. So I have a part of my book talking about when it comes to investing, that inactivity typically most of the time is better than activity. And let me put it this way. So I'm gonna introduce one study, then I'm gonna hit a second one that hits the dead person. So the first study is called Boys Will Be Boys, a study of gender differences in investing. And these academics somehow got a discount brokerage that's unnamed in their academic paper, but a discount brokerage to give them 10 years of data on 35,000 investment accounts. And what they found was that the best performers were single females, followed by married females who were, of course, dragged down by their husbands. The married men pulled up by their wives, and single males, and sorry, all you single males out there, bringing up the rear. They were in the caboose.
What?
And why was this the case? So here's what the paper found. They found that both genders, regardless of marital status, did equally as bad at making investment decisions. They found that on average, everything they sold outperformed everything they bought, on average. So in other words, if on average your investment decisions are bad, you should make less decisions when it comes to investing. And that's what they found. The single females traded 45% less than the single males.
Wow. They bought and hold. Is that what it is? Basically, that's it?
Yeah. So basically it is, you know, once you're invested, unless you did a really bad job to begin with, in general, you shouldn't be making trades. And so basically if you're a male, you should try to invest like a female, because what they found is that the males, when it came to investing, were more overconfident than the females. The females were overconfident too. Like they traded when they shouldn't have, but the males traded more. And so that was the issue. But then there was the study by Fidelity. Now, this was an internal study that they didn't release, but they talked about it in the media. And they looked to see what are the characteristics of their best performing accounts over 10 years. And they found that their top performing accounts were those of dead people and accounts that had been locked. So like if you switched a job and, you know, you didn't move your 401k account. And I'll tell you, I lived this. I have been living this. So this summer, I will have been married 30 years to my wife. And when we got married 30 years ago, she changed her last name from Simmons to Jennings on her driver's license, on her passport, and on other like accounts and everything. What she didn't do is change it with the Social Security Administration. So according to the Social Security Administration, her Social Security number is for Tammy Simmons, not Tammy Jennings. Well, Schwab, where she had an IRA, picked up on this about 15, 17 years ago, and they locked her IRA account because the name on the account didn't match the Social Security number. And just like changing her name with Social Security Administration, also getting that account unlocked has been like on her to-do list for over a decade.
Wow.
But every time
she forgot about it, didn't look at it, didn't worry about it, didn't make it.
And I'm the only one that sees it. She doesn't log into her IRA. Like, you know, I'm the financial person. So every time I see, and it's, you know, in the grand scheme of our, you know, our investments, it's not a big account. But for the last, you know, 15 plus years, I will log in and I will see like this time capsule of these investments that I selected 15 plus years ago. and I cannot change them. And every time I've wanted to change them, I can't. And it's not that big of an account. So I've been like, whatever. And it's invested in three funds, two index funds, one active manager, a Dodge and Cox fund, Dodge and Cox Global. And guess what? It's done awesome.
Just make a decision, put it in there. Don't look at it. That's the answer.
It's like I'm an investment professional and it has done better than other accounts where I've been able to make changes. So it applies to me as well. And so I'll tell you, for all of you out there that invested in, you know, stocks, you know, in general, don't be tinkering with things. Tinkering leads to underperformance. So if, again, if you're male, invest like you're female. If you're female, invest like you're dead. Like the account is locked. And like, you can't do that 100% of the time. You know, you're going to add money, hopefully. Maybe sometimes you're pulling out money. Maybe, you know, hopefully you're disciplined. And if you're like, oh, okay, 80% stocks, 20% bonds, you know, if the stocks are up, you add to bonds and vice versa. So it's not like you should do nothing. But in general, like before you make an investment change, like go take a walk, read a book, give yourself a week.
Man. It does fall in line with a study I heard not too long ago, and they were doing some type of evaluation on Parkinson's law. I don't know if you're familiar with that law, but basically the amount of time you give yourself, that's how long it's going to take. And what they found out is that the more time you give yourself, the actual less likelihood it's actually going to get done. And what's even cooler is that the more time, the more variables enter your brain, and therefore you actually make worse decisions.
Amen.
So what's crazy is that, and there's a crazy study out there, guys. If you want to look it up, they asked a bunch of United States citizens on which two cities, you know, which one's bigger, and then they went to a completely different country and they said which city has more has a higher population. The individuals who didn't live in the United States were more accurate because they just heard of one and they're like, I heard of that city before. Let's go with that one. So one variable led to a much better decision than the people who lived in the United States and they've heard of many cities. So they're like, oh, well, you know, let me think about it. Let me evaluate. It's wild. So more variables, not necessarily a good thing. Is that right?
Amen. And in fact, that is one of the sections in my book.
Oh,
it is absolutely. And it gets into why one of the reasons why experts are so bad at predicting what's going to happen in the economy or in investments or in politics. And a reason is that it is too many variables. And there was this amazing paper that was done. The title, I'm not going to get exactly correct, but it was the number 7 plus or minus 2 was like the name of the papers. It's not exactly right, but it's something like that. And basically what it found is that in our working memory, which is where we mainly do our thinking, we can only hold 5 to 9 items of information. So 7 plus or minus 2.
Wow.
And what happens is we think that having more information is helpful. But once we have more information, our brains can't handle it. And so what we'll end up doing is instead of focusing on the factors that are the most important, we'll be focusing on all sorts of other factors. And it makes us... It gives us more confidence to have more information, but it actually harms our ability to predict, which is exactly the point, you know, Mike, that you made. And one of my favorite studies on that was actually looking at bettors for college football. And what they did is they took, you know, games that had actually been played, but they changed the name of the teams to like Team A versus Team B, C versus D, whatever. And they started off in the first round, they gave them a bunch of college football, you know, matchups, didn't tell them the score, but said, you know, going in, here are 6 items of information that are the same about each team. I mean, it'd be things like win and loss record, you know, points for, against, yardage, things like that. How confident are you that you can pick a winner and who do you pick? And what they found is after 6 items of information, their confidence was, you know, it was decent. And their ability to pick, they got about 2/3 right. So that was pretty good. So they changed it to 12 items of information, and then they gave them 18, and then they gave them 24, and then they gave them 30. And at each instance that they gave them more information, their confidence in their ability to pick a winning football club increased and increased and increased, but their ability to predict dropped.
So they felt better about the decision that they made, yes. But the results were worse.
The results were worse. And this happens all over the place, especially in investments, but even with medical decision-making and political predictions, like if you have too many items of information, you cannot digest it all because you get you get more than, you know, this handful, you know, 5 to 9 items of information. Well, there's another study that found it's only 4 items of information. And that is just, you know, human nature. It happens with stock picking. And really, thank you for bringing it up. This is what my book is about. These are mental models that we store away in our heads that will make us better investors. Things like, in general, we should be more inactive, right? So you think about, you know, investing like a woman if you're a male, or if you're female, invest like a dead person. Another mental model is that the more confident somebody is, the less able they are to make predictions. That's another great one. So really what you want to hear is from experts that aren't confident in their prediction ability.
That is crazy. Yeah. See, the more you understand psychology in general, it just makes you a better investor slash person that can read other people's body language, right? I think that's probably right. What you picked up more so than anything else. Man, so the uncertainty solution, I like the title of this. And as entrepreneurs, we're out there, we love an uncertainty. Where there's chaos, there's opportunity. Where people can't really see the future, we can create it, right? So as an entrepreneur, it's a great thing. For the average person out there, they want this sure bet. It's just absolutely impossible. So what is the genesis behind this book? What made you want to write this? Was it your clients coming to you with, you know, they had all these preconceived notions that were absolutely wrong, and you're like, let's write this ship?
Yeah. So really, I wrote the book to spread truth and transparency around investing and the investment management industry. I'm taking the gloves off against the investment management industry. And first, let me step back and let me explain who I am and what my firm is. People may be like, why am I listening to this guy? So our firm, we are what's known as a multifamily office. We've been in business coming on 22 years. We were formed out of the ashes of Arthur Andersen. So it was one of the big 5 accounting firms. Now there's just a big 4, you know, in the wake of the Enron scandal. So nothing to do with, you know, those of us in investment wealth management at Andersen. But we work only with 63 families. We have 65 employees, 63 families. And for those 63 families, we oversee $15 billion of total net worth.
Jeez. And yeah, are these the families that we probably know?
I don't know that any of them are famous enough that you would know. No, okay. They're just extremely, you know, extremely wealthy, you know, families. And a lot of them, made their money by owning a business and then they sold it. So, or sometimes they were, you know, a CEO at a publicly traded company and they retired, or somebody that had an ancestor that was one of those too. But really you have to have equity to vault into that sort of level of wealth. So our average client family has, I don't know, nearly $250 million, or median's about 175. And so we work with extremely, extremely wealthy, very complex, you know, clients is what we do. And really we only take on about 3 client families a year, but we have a very high batting average going up against the big brokerage firms like Goldman or Morgan Stanley, or, you know, big banks like Northern Trust, Bank of America, Bessemer, things like that. And how are we gaining client families against these big firms? And there's a number of reasons, and, you know, our structure and some of the service we provide. But part of it is we select for families that when we tell them the truth about investing, they like that. In fact, we have quite a few client families that they made their money in investing. And really the truth is this, that to invest well, you don't need to be able to predict the future. And that's a good thing, because you can't. And much of what the industry is selling is false certainty. You know, they bring in, you know, they're people that have been on CNBC and they're talking heads and they're constantly putting out, you know, all these things in the media about, you know, what they think is going to happen to the economy and what they think is going to happen to the stock market. It's going to do this and that and interest rates and everything else. And they are horrible at predicting these things. Mm-hmm. And we train our clients to invest as if we don't know, because we don't. And that's actually how you're going to be a much more successful investor. So really the title of the book is The Uncertainty Solution. And, you know, I have an interesting story of how I came up with that, that title. But anyway, the solution is this. It's really to accept and embrace the uncertainty. And to the extent that makes you, you know, have discomfort, which it does for most people, it's to sit in that discomfort, you know, and to know how the world really works and accept it instead of doing the things that are counterproductive that we usually do in the face of uncertainty, which is to make investment decisions, it's to trade, it's to listen to experts, it's to use the false certainty of bell curves when they don't apply to investing, and on and on and on and on. So that's really what my book is about, and what I deliver in the book is these mental models. It's not how to invest, because how could I in a book tell you how to invest? Like, I don't know your financial situation or your risk tolerance or, you know, how much liquidity you have or what your goals are or how many kids you have or anything. Like, I don't know any of that. So the book's not like, how should you invest? It's how should you think about investing and about uncertainty?
Yeah. And yeah, you're very clear in the subtitle, how to invest with confidence in the face of the unknown.
Yeah.
And so I would assume it's very much like the Socratic method. Before you even can give any type of advice, you're going to ask a lot of questions, and therefore you tailor it to the answers. So
yeah, absolutely.
You bring up a very good point about the talking heads on TV. I went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I was a finance major. And I remember in the school, it was nonstop Jim Cramer. Now, as I got older, I realized Jim Cramer was pretty much wrong on it, pretty much everything that I've ever seen him.
But he's entertaining.
He's entertaining. He can get on there. He's loud. He's just completely unique. But people are watching him and listening to him. It just blows my mind. And so that's who you're up against, right? People who think they have all the answers, and they might be telling people really bad information, and then, you know, tomorrow is another day and they're on to something new. Yep. So the That's enemies right. out there are, I would assume you see those people and it just like rubs you the wrong way, because it makes that whole industry look bad. Is that right?
It does. And I think, you know, I put investment experts kind of in two camps. Well, I guess there's really more like three camps, but the two camps are, you know, they know what they don't know. And those that don't know what they don't know, you know, and it's interesting. I'm on a number of charitable boards. In fact, I'm the chair of a $250 million endowment and other charitable boards that we have endowments. And, you know, we bring in these, you know, we use investment consultants and investment managers and they come in and again, they give these predictions of the economy and the stock market and this, that, and this and that. And if I question them, again, they fall in these camps, the ones that know that they don't know. And I'll be like, well, why are you doing all this if you know that you're not good at this? And they usually say something like, you know, well, it's what clients want. Like, they don't want me to come in and just say, you know, there's so much that we don't know. and then you have the ones that don't know that they don't know, that they actually like believe they do know, even though history shows that they don't know. And again, I have a section in my book, why don't experts learn from their mistakes? And there's certain things that you can look at to tell if an investment expert has learned from their mistakes or not. And a common, you know, excuses they make that they haven't learned from their mistakes was, you know, first of all, they'll say, oh, I was just early. So they predict something's going to happen and it doesn't. They were just early. Yeah. And maybe they are sometimes, but that's a big one. Another is the market acted irrationally. But a third one of my favorites is something unexpected happened. And I'll give you a story of this. So back in 2010, we were investing in this manager that was a deep value manager, and we used their international strategy. And I remember we had a call in late 2010, and they were like, you know, we are pivoting to overweight Japanese stocks because we think, you know, the companies are undervalued. The growth prospects for Japan are not widely recognized. So we're going to do more Japan stocks. And we're like, okay, whatever. Okay, so March of 2011, of course, there's an earthquake. There's a tsunami. It slams into the coast. You have the Fukushima disaster, reactor disaster meltdown. And it tanks the Japanese economy and the stocks along with it. So a few months later, we have a call with this investment manager, and, you know, and we're nice. Like, you know, we're in the Midwest, we're Midwesterners. We try to be nice, but we kind of nicely said, basically, you guys messed up. Like, this was a horrible, horrible decision to overweight Japanese stocks. And their response was, well, we would have been right, but we can't predict natural
Now. Yeah, of course.
And they're right. They can't. But here's the deal. Like, you don't get a mulligan or a do-over just because the unexpected happens. I mean, pandemics happen, right? As we found out. And wars break out. I mean, look at Ukraine and Israel and Hamas, right? You know, boats get stuck in shipping containers. You know, there's unexpected election results. There are natural disasters. So all of these things happen. And in general, the investment industry just goes along and makes predictions and ignores the fact that most of the really important things that are really going to move the economy and the markets are unpredictable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that what you're talking about too in the book, more so than anything, is just psychology in general. And I like how you're able to kind of call bullshit on people. And right, they all have these like plan Bs of like, well, something happened, it was out of our control. But if you can read people, you can do wonders. And so I really want to leave enough time in this podcast, because is there any other cool stat or study that you came across? Sounds like you're very well read, and I'm a big Jordan Peterson fan, and talks about how rats are more motivated by fears rather than wants. So a lot of people make their decisions out of fears rather than what they actually want. And then the other aspect is like, there's a great study out there called the chocolate cookie and the radish. Have you ever heard of that study?
I have not. Tell me about it.
Basically, there's two rooms, group of people. They're both rooms are given a plate of cookies, really great looking, smelling chocolate chip cookies, and a plate of radishes. In the other room, same deal. One room is told you can't eat the radishes, and the other ones are told you can't eat the cookies. So the whole radishes, I don't know if you've ever had one, but they're disgusting. And so it's not a big deal to say, like, I'm not going to eat radish. I'll have the cookies. Cool. So then they give both rooms a test. And it's an impossible test. And so there's no way out of it. And so they just watch these people. How long does it take for each room to actually give up on the test? And what they found out was the room that was told you can't eat the delicious cookies gave up way faster, because their willpower of saying no to the cookie drained their whole body and said, all right, this test is too hard now. The hell with this, right? So willpower plays a factor. And when I look at all this stuff, when it comes to investing, or whether it comes to even 2008, that crisis, you know, willpower, fears, motivations, understanding where there's opportunity when people are running, you run in. Like, I'm starting to understand what is the average person thinking? Okay, well, I'm just going to position myself in a way that reaps the rewards. So therefore, it might make me a better investor. Any cool stats or studies like that that you could share that would make individuals out there better investors?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, something that's incredibly powerful that is underappreciated is regression to the mean, right? And here's a story that I tell in my book. So years ago, we had this like young investment analyst, and he left our firm to go work for a much bigger, you know, like brokerage firm. And the reason he left is he said, you know, you're not giving me enough opportunity to pick like managers that are going to outperform. And we do a lot of indexing, by the way. So he was like, you know, there's not enough picking managers that outperform or whatever. And I sat down with him. And I was like, in his exit interview, and I said, well, you know, why don't we have a little contest? Why don't we each pick a domestic active manager? We will pick an international active manager and a bond active manager. And I think it was 4 or 5 years later, you know, whoever beats the other will pay the other $100. So he spent, you know, he had given us 2 weeks. So he spent a lot of time, and he came up doing all this research, these three active managers. And I spent less than 2 minutes. So at the time we used an investment consultant, and I picked three managers that were on their watch list because they had performed crappy and they were getting ready to fire. And after the 4-year period, like, it wasn't even close. And all I did was counted on regression to the mean. And, you know, I think it is completely under appreciated that there was no necessary cause for it. It's just a rule of life in mathematics. When any two things are less than perfectly correlated, there will be regression to the mean. And if you think about it, like, we always jump to causation, even when there's not necessarily a cause. So like, if you have a situation where you have like, you know, tall parents, you'll say, okay, regression of the mean will say that the kids on average will be a little shorter, right? You're like, okay, this regression towards the mean. But the opposite is true as well. If you have a tall child, on average, the parents will be shorter. Huh. Right. In the first one, you're like, okay, that makes sense, because you can think of the genetics and, you know, time flows, you know, from the parent to the child. But regression of the mean works both directions. Tall children, on average, have shorter parents.
Oh my God.
I know. When I first heard that, it made my head hurt. But it is just math of regression to the mean. And that example of the parents and children, I think, help us separate out and just say that this is a mathematical rule that doesn't have to have a cause.
Wow. I mean, just the law of numbers in general, is that, yeah, that's all it is. Law of averages.
Well, and this works because there is not perfect correlation between parental and child height. It's actually, depending on which study you look at, it's actually about a 0.5. So, you know, it's a positive correlation. It's a, you know, relatively strong correlation, but it is not a perfect correlation. So wherever you have less than perfect correlation, you have, and you can use a bell curve, you have regression to the mean, and that's what happens. And, you know, it's pretty, that rule alone will tell you a lot about investing, which is, you know, when you have an investment that's doing crappy, you know, maybe you should add to it instead of exit it.
Man, it makes you think of it in a different way.
Yeah, it really does. You know, but it's not a universal rule when it comes to investing, because sometimes crappy investments just stay crappy or they go out of business. And you can look back and go, okay, you know, small caps have underperformed large caps, and values out underperformed growth, you know, mostly for, you know, most years since the, you know, the financial crisis. And, you know, you would expect that to regress back, and it likely will, but it's really testing the limits of our patience, isn't it?
Jeez. Now, you get to be around some really wealthy families. Rich Dad Poor Dad is the book that I always bring up, because it helped me understand how the wealthy think when it comes to assets as compared to liabilities. And since I've read that book, I was able to work with many people and, you know, be in certain rooms with multimillionaires, including billionaires. And now I'm able to see how they think to a certain degree. What have you noticed amongst how these individuals look at wealth creation or wealth impact, right? So have you noticed that there's a common trend amongst them where they're looking generations from now or having some type of impact globally, economically? What have you seen?
Yeah, it's hard to see. You know, what I've found by working with the kind of what I'll call the uber wealthy is first and foremost, they're just people. You know, they still have their, you know, their fears and their concerns, and also, you know, their wants and their dreams and their hopes. But I think the thing that would surprise probably most people in America about the super wealthy is a lot of them still have, you know, quite a bit of fear around wealth still. You know, you could have tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars and still not feel completely financially secure. You can still have stress about money and spending. You can still want more than what you're willing to, a higher lifestyle than what maybe your assets can support. So it's just, you know, higher.
Very subjective is what you're saying.
We've run into, you know, people that have, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that still have issue with like credit card debt. And just because you have that much money doesn't mean that, you know, it's all liquid. And we have clients that, you know, they spend too much based on what their goals are. You know, they have hundreds of millions of dollars, but they're spending millions and millions, you know, a year. There's still comparison, and and in fact, my next book is on money and happiness.
Wow.
And, you know, there's no like plateau, or there's no easy street that you get to where your problems in life and even your problems about money go away. And if anything, there's almost like this inverted U. So if you have a U that's, you know, this would be more of a hump, where when you have very little money, you have money problems, right? And then you have like lesser money problems as you gain more money. But for a lot of families, you tilt into, when you have a lot of money, where it causes stress and worry again. So you're worried about preserving it. You're worried about growing it. You're worried about being a steward of it. It can create friction and issues among family members. It can create issues with your friends. It can take a lot of time and effort to manage the money itself. Plus, you tend to, your standard of living, your lifestyle tends to creep and creep and creep up. And so you have this situation where, you know, I have this friend that's from an incredibly wealthy family. He's, you know, he's, you know, like fourth generation wealth. And he says that stuff equals stress, and it does, you know, mm-hmm. And you can just imagine, like, if you just drive like a regular car, like you just like, okay, I just drive a Camry, right? And you're like, you know, you park it and if it gets a door ding, you maybe not like, oh, well, that's the end of the world. And, you know, if your kids are in the back seat and they're eating like French fries, you're like, whatever. But you can imagine, like, if you buy a Bentley, like you're going to be so stressed about that car you know, getting door dings and nobody gets to eat in your car and whatever. And I think that just applies to so many things. Like, the nicer stuff you have and the more that you have, and, you know, we have clients and they have like all these different houses, different places. And then you know, and some of them are in paths of hurricanes or, you know, wildfires, and they're worried about that. They're worried about what the wealth is going to do to their kids. You know, shared ownership of vacation properties, tough. You end up having household staff, maybe you have a plane, maybe you have boats, and it starts taking over. It can start taking over your life.
Yep.
And part of the issue is like, then how do you have all this wealth and use it to make a positive dent in the universe, to make it a positive for your family, to make it a positive for your own, you know, life satisfaction? And yeah, again, that's what my next book's about.
Man. So you were making me think of dopamine. So I don't know if you've ever read the book Molecule of More. Have you ever read that book? Mm-hmm. Okay. So it talks about how dopamine pretty much drives all of us, more so men, because we just feed off it. And so I would assume that the individuals who are trading more are trying to chase that dopamine hit, right? I made a move, therefore I had a windfall, whether it's $100, $1,000 or $1,000,000. We're all searching for that. And so have you noticed anything amongst that individuals who make a certain amount of money lose that big win? And so they're always searching for it. And whether it's externally through gambling or really poor decision-making or certain investments that really excite them, but they're just not great on paper. Like, have you noticed that happens whenever you hit a certain level? Because I've seen it personally.
Yeah, I don't know, even with a certain level, because I just think, you know, we have some clients that have a ton of money, made a ton of money, that, you know, really aren't all that interested in investing. And, you know, we do more simple, lower cost, lower tax portfolios that tend to do really well. And then we have some people, and it's
boring. It sounds like, oh, this isn't exciting to them, but it works, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you, like, boring investing usually beats the more complex, fancy investing. But yeah, we have some that, you know, I'll tell you, I mentioned this story in my book. So like 7 or 8 years ago, I was preparing for some client meetings coming up, and I was looking through the performance of these various clients that were, you know, there's two in particular, and you know, client A, well, not their real name, client A had returned like, you know, 8.3% over the last 10 years. And client B over the same time period had earned like 5.2%. So there was like a 3% difference, and just huge. The difference between earning 5.2 and 8.3 over a 10-year time period is gargantuan, gargantuan. And the person with the 5.2, the lower percent return, lives in New York City and is a retired investment banker. And his portfolio at the time was well over $100 million. Client A, with the higher return of 8.3, was the housekeeper for one of our clients.
Oh.
And she was invested in 4 index funds, probably one more than she needed. And she didn't know anything about investing, didn't read the Wall Street Journal, didn't watch CNBC. And she just did whatever we told her to, which was just rebalance every once in a while and don't look at your portfolio. And she was completely inactive. And the investment banker, you know, he had all these friends, you know, he on Wall Street, and he had all these different investment funds he wanted to go into all the time, and was always making trades and decisions largely against our advice. So after seeing this, I actually went out and met with him alone, and I was going to have what I kind of referred to as, you know, my come to Jesus talk with him. And I laid out the 2 sets of returns, and I said, here's your returns, and here's this $40,000, you know, account. And, you know, let's learn from this. And as we were talking, I asked a question. I said, you know, if you could have another percent or 2 or 3% annualized return from here on out, would you invest like this housekeeper? And he said, no. He's like, the way I keep myself busy and interested is I invest. My social circle is all about talking about investments and trading investment ideas. It is worth it to me to underperform a simple index portfolio to be a sophisticated investor. And that was amazing that he admitted that.
Wow.
But I think that's true for a lot of people. And I'll tell you, I work with a lot of, I know a lot of people that have kind of, you know, exited their companies and they've created their own, you know, single family office or, you know, spend all their time, you know, managing their investments. And that's what they do. And most of the time, they are not getting market returns. They're investing in businesses and deals and funds that, you know, blow up, that don't do well, you know, their friends tell them about. They're not adopting a, you know, really institutional, disciplined way of investing. And, but they love it. Like, this is what's filling their free time after they've exited their business. You know, there's only, you know, I met with someone that was like, you know, there's only, now that I've sold my business, I'm like tired of just shooting birds and, you know, hitting golf balls. I need something else to do. So he was managing his own investments, even though he had made his money in, you know, manufacturing, and he was going to underperform the housekeeper, but that's what he wanted to do.
So individuals out there, once they hit a certain level, will try to keep themselves busy. And right, it just makes sense that maybe somebody,
well, some of them.
Yes. Yeah. Not all of them, but they all need something to pursue, right? There's a level of mastery, and just by being in the game, it's still fun for them. And it's not about the money, I guess, at that point. It's more so, how do I stay relative or valuable or in the game to some degree? And that's
all these people. And I have friends like this. I'm you know, about to turn 54, and I have friends that are like, you know, oh, you know, they work really hard. They save a lot of money. They're like, what's my number so I can, you know, retire? But I'm like, what are you going to retire to? What are you going to do, you know, with your time? You know, they, you know, they might play golf or, you know, like to bike or whatever, but it's like, you got to have something else, you know? And you know who, Naval Ravikant is, if I'm pronouncing that right. Naval Ravikant.
I know a Naval. I don't remember that last name though.
So he's a venture capitalist and kind of like a amateur philosopher. And there's this great book that this other person wrote based, it's called The Almanac of Naval Ravikant. And it's a great book. And he wrote it with his permission. And it's based on Naval's, his blog posts and him being on a bunch of podcasts. And there's a few things Naval says in that book that I found incredibly, wise. You know, one, and this is that, you know, being happy means being satisfied with what you have. Being successful means being dissatisfied. Choose. But anyway, the one I was going to hit is, he said his definition of retirement is when you stop trading your todays for an imaginary tomorrow. So it's when you actually, when you wake up in the morning, you have the freedom to choose what you want to do, and then you do it. And I think that's so profound, because so many people view as, okay, I'm going to build a business, or I'm going to save a lot of money, and at some point I'm going to exit, or I'm going to retire, so I have leisure time.
Yeah.
Really, what you don't want is excess leisure time. What you want is to be doing what you want to do. And I have, you know, a big reason we start working with families is the number one reason is they're about to, or they've just exited their company. And there is a period after they've exited, and it can stretch for decades, where they're just lost. They are rudderless. And like, you know, I've spent all this time and effort, you know, buying into success and money and everything. And I thought that there was going to be this easy street or this plateau I hit, and then I could relax and everything would be great. And then they do that for about 2 weeks, and then they start going nuts. And the problem is if you are so driven, you know, the type of person that exits their company for tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, or especially billions of dollars, like, you are obsessed. You are driven. You're probably not spending a lot of time and effort cultivating, you know, maybe some hobbies or some non-business things. And so when, you know, it's the bigger the void, is harder to fill. It is so difficult. I've seen it happen over and over. In fact, so when we start working with a family and they're exiting, you know, we give them books to read. We give them papers to read on this topic. We absolutely recommend that they start in therapy, like, right away. It's like, if you don't have a therapist, you need a therapist, and you need one now.
Pretty amazing to even say that out loud, that they will need a therapist after they sell for hundreds of millions of dollars. But I do believe that a man needs struggle. And you know, these individuals who are creating this wealth, it's in their identity. And so the moment you take that person out of that environment, it's like you hit a peak, right? Everybody wants to have that view that they're on the peak. You need another peak to go for. Otherwise you will feel lost. And so,
yeah. So, there was a special on Netflix, and it was about Urban Meyer with the Florida Gators and their national championship runs.
I have not seen that.
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing. And it really, you know, something that was really telling is the night that Florida won, I forget, is either the first or second national championship. They go back to the locker room, and Urban Meyer, after 5 minutes, went straight to his office and started texting and calling recruits for the next year.
Oh my God.
He never even stopped to savor it. And Edmund Hillary, when he was the first person to summit Everest, when he got to the top of Everest, the story is that one of the first things he did is started looking around at the other mountains on what would be another good challenge to pursue. And on one hand, that's great. You can go, like, we always need a challenge. But on the other hand, it's also kind of sad. And there is this, and what I was trying to come up with the quote is the bigger the goal, the bigger the hole. And like, I know all this, like this, I've researched this topic, and this is such a big topic in my next book. And when I stopped writing my first book, when I was done with it, I went into about a 3 month, like kind of minor depression.
Because it was over.
I didn't have a big challenge. And there was a lot to do, still production of the book, and been on, I don't know, 30, 40 podcasts, like speeches, there's promoting the book, but it wasn't the same as the unbelievable challenge of writing. And I write for Forbes. I write a blog a few times a week. I teach at Washington University. I have my day job, but still was sort of depressed. So, you know, people have to be careful that, you know, once you, any sort of big goal, like you run a marathon, like I've run 4 marathons, after each marathon, like you feel good for about a day, then you're just like,
Yeah, we need a dragon in our life to slay. And so
we do.
Be careful what you ask for, and because you might just get it. And so that's interesting that you bring that up. I talk about that a lot, where, you know, the individual who makes $1 million in a year and then maybe drops down to maybe $900,000 a year is actually way less happy than the person who made $100,000 and then went to $200,000, right? So, like, you would look at those two people and
totally.
The person who makes $900,000 is probably still way happier. No, if there's no progress in your life, right? Happiness, as Jordan Peterson said, is the awareness that you are progressing towards a goal, not obtaining the goal. That's pretty cool to say. So anyway, you're a Jordan Peterson fan? It sounds like you are, just so you know.
No, you know, I've never read any Jordan Peterson.
Oh, man, you're talking just like him, just so you know. I like what you're preaching, because it falls in alignment with him.
So I own his main book. What's it called?
12 Rules?
Yeah. I own it. I haven't read it, so I will I'll move it up my queue.
Don't even read it. Just listen to his speeches, because the way he speaks is actually better than what's in the book. And so I would, and if you're going to do the audiobook, make sure it's his voice. Means okay. a lot. Yeah. Anyways, John, I could hold you all day here. We could talk psychology and money. You're a fascinating guy, but is there a social media channel or a website you want people to look up? Or
yeah, so,
just go get the book.
Yeah. So always appreciate book sales. You know, it's that's great. But I have a website. It's John, as in J-O-H-N, M as in Michael, Jennings.com. So JohnMJennings.com. And importantly, you know, I have this blog that I do a few times a week called The Interesting Fact of the Day. And if you go to that website, up at the top in the menu, it says The IFOD, The Interesting Fact of the Day. And I'd love to have people as subscribers. So I just publish on different interesting things. I get about 30,000 page views a month. And, you know, some of my most popular are, you know, what happens to a bullet shot straight up in the air? It's kind of interesting.
I love this stuff.
Why do females have neater handwriting than males usually? How many people are over 7 foot tall? Why do competitors so often put their stores next to each other? Why do you see a Home Depot and a Lowe's or a CVS and Walgreens like right next to each other down the street? So I have just interesting things like that. So yeah, always love new subscribers.
Man, yeah, that's the type of stuff I look up. I just, what I found out is that I learn more if I share that information with people. Yeah. So on my stories on Instagram, I'll learn these crazy stats about, you know, whether it's depression or income levels and all that. And I just share it on Instagram. So it'll go from like dog video to, you know, interesting stats about how individuals think of themselves at 17 years old, right? So like it's all over the place, but the more you learn, the more you can share, and it completes the hero's journey. I'm assuming you're into that world, you know, Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. By learning or accomplishing something, it's only in your, it's a moral obligation to give back to those and share the wisdom with the many. So yeah, it's on johnmjennings.com. The fact of the day, is that what you said?
Yep. Interesting fact of the day, the iPod, IFOD.
Good. I'll check it out.
So it's on there. So yeah. Cool.
John, thanks so much. Guys, the book is called The Uncertainty Solution, How to Invest with Confidence in the Face of the Unknown. The greatest quote of this podcast episode is, invest like a dead man or a dead person. So that's the one. And check them out. Easy to find. Look them up and definitely subscribe. So $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.